just like think about more what I want to do with my life.
Cool. Where are you leaning right now?
I'm like in the middle of everything. Yeah.
Welcome to Translation. I'm your host, Seth Bannon, a founding partner at 50 Years, a venture capital firm backing founders using technology to solve the world's biggest problems. Translation is the process of turning basic scientific research into therapies that cure disease, new sources of energy that heal the planet, and other things that move the world forward. This podcast takes a deep dive into scientific achievements with huge potential to improve society. We talk directly with the people advancing the science with their own hands and minds, and focus on how we can translate the science from the bench to the benefit of all. Welcome to Translation.
Behind every success, there are people with the courage to try, try,
try. To create new sources of energy, to fix the carbon in our atmosphere, to cure disease.
Hey everyone, it's Michael Chavez, co-host of Translation, fellow at 50 Years, and graduate student at Stanford University. Today we are talking to Leo Vo about his paper, CRISPR RNA-guided integrases for high-efficiency multiplex bacterial genome engineering, which was published in Nature Biotechnology in November 2020. To achieve the promise of cell engineering and synthetic biology, scientists are required to introduce new genetic material into an organism of interest. While there are numerous techniques to achieve this, integrating foreign DNA into precise locations on the cell's own genome is highly desirable, as it gives us the greatest control and programmability. However, current methods to do this are extremely laborious and challenging, inhibiting its widespread adoption. Using a new CRISPR-Cas system with novel functionality, Leo vastly outperforms previous methods to integrate large pieces of DNA anywhere in the bacterial genome. With it, he demonstrates how his precision tool can integrate complex programs into cells with the potential to improve medicine and industrial strain engineering. Leo performed this work in the lab of Professor Sam Sternberg at Columbia University.
Leo, welcome to Translation.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And we're also super excited to hear about, you know, your phenomenal work in this paper. But first, we'd just love to know, you know, what got you into chemistry back in the day?
So I think my journey in science has gone through like a little bit of like a winding road. So I started out in high school being really into physics, into like the mechanics, the equations, you know, like the models, because those made a lot of sense to me. And it's just all, you know, like very systematic, just equations, you know, math. And then when I got to college, we had like a really great chemistry department. And also I just got really sick of all the math, I think is the other honest opinion of doing so much physics. So I got into chemistry, which I thought was a very exciting way to apply physical concepts. And organic chemistry was like amazing for me, which I think is not the case for a lot of people who went through orgo.
What did you like about organic chemistry?
It's a lot of memorization. It's a lot of like knowing all the different pathways, but it just made so much sense. And there's so much potential behind it, because you can apply all these small ideas and techniques and build really elaborate molecules. I think I carried a lot of that with me as I kind of entered biology and like synthetic biology. Yeah, it's just the potential of what you can do with simple, maybe not so simple, techniques and concepts.
How did that love of organic chemistry evolve into a passion for biochemistry and synthetic biology?
So I found bio quite late. The first bio class I ever took was in sophomore year in college. And I was like, you know, like intro bio, memorizing like species and stuff. And I just remember being so blown away by all these really elegant solutions that nature came up with to achieve certain results, right? Even just like the bilayer lipid membrane, where you have the cells being encoded in this like membrane. I just remember that just blowing my mind. And I thought that I just want to explore it a little bit more, because I didn't think at the time that I was going to do any bio in my future. It was mostly going to be chemistry. And bio is just like a curiosity thing. But as I went more and more into it, eventually I just started thinking that, wow, I really want to do this in a bit more further depth. And I just kind of fell in love with it, I guess is the best way to describe it. And
cool.
Yeah. And so that's where I began. I slowly transitioned away from doing so much chemistry to taking more and more bio classes. And at the end of college, I kind of just took the leap and I basically just applied to a PhD program in bio. And somehow I got in, and that's where I am now.
So, Leo, in a few sentences, can you describe your paper to a general audience?
Yeah. So the paper essentially was me optimizing and demonstrating a system that we had been working on in the lab to engineer the genomes of bacteria. And we do this by using a modified CRISPR system that is able to insert potentially very large sequences of DNA into the genomes of bacteria. And this system we discovered in Nature back in 2018, 2019. And I took it and I basically looked at all the flaws it had, all the shortcomings, and then all the potential it has, and fleshed all of them out in one project.
CRISPR is obviously a hot topic at the moment. It has uses in improving agriculture, curing disease, understanding biology at a throughput never before possible. You know, we could spend many episodes just talking about CRISPR, but at its simplest, CRISPR is used as a catch-all for a group of proteins that can be directed to cut nucleic acids, usually DNA, at a very specific sequence of the user's choice. So why is this targeted cutting ability so exciting?
I think it's just the simplicity of it. And I think it's something that I guess I have almost taken for granted as I've been working in the field for so long. But I think to any newcomer, just the idea of being able to specify a sequence and say, let's target this sequence in the DNA, is so simple and yet so powerful that it just has this potential to change the world. And I think this is a great time to talk about CRISPR because of, you know, like the Nobel Prize late last fall and all this mainstream interest in CRISPR that's been growing for the last couple of years, you know, from the public, the private sector, even the government. And yeah, I was talking to, we had this course that we taught for high school students that we just wrapped up, where we basically just taught them CRISPR and gene editing using CRISPR. And I just can't foresee, you know, I really can't imagine doing that with any other technology because it's just so powerful, yet it just, it's easy to explain. And so the idea is you just have a protein or a complex of proteins that is guided by a piece of RNA, and it's sometimes called the CRISPR RNA or a guide RNA. And this contains a sequence called the spacer. And in Cas9, which is a very common CRISPR-Cas system, you have a 20 base pair, a 20 nucleotide spacer sequence. In the type 1 systems, you have a 32 base pair. Essentially, it's a sequence of RNA that matches the target DNA sequence that you want to target. And that is the entirety of the concept. You design a spacer sequence. A common analogy is a search and replace function on like a word processor where you say, this is the sequence I want to find, type it in, and then the program will search for it. And that's essentially what the CRISPR-Cas system does. You give it a sequence and it does its job.
It is mind-bending that high school students are editing genomes, right? I mean, it just, you know, 10 years ago, that would just be sort of unthinkable. But because it's so simple to use, we can now teach high school biology students. So, you know, you mentioned that you took it for granted. Why was doing this kind of sort of targeted cutting hard before CRISPR?
Right. So making, I guess, damage in DNA before CRISPR was very much possible. So right before CRISPR was the TALENs, which was pioneered by Feng Zhang, who's now a CRISPR pioneer. So that's a fun coincidence, but TALENs were essentially these blocky proteins that were coding for the target at the protein level. And so you had blocks of protein. Each block can recognize one base, one A, T, G, or C. And so to recognize a sequence of DNA, you would chain the blocks together and make one big protein that is able to recognize and bind to the sequence you want. Before that, you had the zinc finger nucleases, which were a more complex form of a TALEN where I guess each block of protein recognizes three bases. And so you have to play around with the possible combinations. But these things were able to do their job. They were just simply hard to manufacture for each experiment and they were hard to scale up. So you can do one cut at one site, but if you want to do two or three at the same time, I think that's still not possible today or not possible with ease. Whereas CRISPR, the idea is that you're programming the target as an RNA. As a piece of RNA, which is in 2021 is just amazing how cheap it is to just buy it from a company. It's actually just, you know, like dirt cheap to buy.
To make these targeted cuts with the previous systems, it was a protein engineering problem, right? Which is an extremely difficult issue. Now we just essentially have a printing problem, which is being solved better and better every day. But why do we even want to make these targeted cuts, right? Like what happens after I make that cut and why is that interesting for biotechnology?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Essentially, gene editing, at least in the current thinking, is that a lot of the methods involve making damage to DNA and having that damage be repaired by either the host cell or some exogenous machinery that you introduce. And through that repair, you introduce your edit of choice. And that's how you edit a gene or a genome of a host. And
awesome.
So this is kind of the original way that Cas9 was used. And it's, I guess, still being used. This is like the alpha version of using Cas9 to edit mammalian genomes, is that you make what's called a double-strand break with Cas9. You give it a spacer sequence as part of the guide RNA that has the 20 base pair of that matches the target that you want to target. Cas9 uses that to locate the target and make a cut, double-strand break. So it breaks both strands of the DNA at that site. And then you allow the cell to repair that break. And through that repair, you can go through this pathway that essentially repairs it with errors. And that leads to errors being introduced into a gene. And usually that leads to a knockout of a gene. So that's how you basically turn off a gene almost permanently using Cas9. There are problems with that approach. And that's something that people have been trying to solve for a while, ever since, people have been using zinc finger nucleases and TALENs to make these cuts, even before CRISPR. Is that if you want to introduce a desired edit, the efficiency, which is the success rate of this happening, is kind of low. It's really, I think the early versions were like a single digit percentage of it happening successfully. And so there are two ways for you to fix this. One is to dive deep into the DNA repair mechanism of the cell to try to understand exactly what is causing this low efficiency and how can you modify the cell to kind of push it towards the other direction. Or you can go away from this double-strand break idea and try to introduce your DNA damage in a different form so that you have to rely less on the cell.
So the CRISPR that's most well-known is Cas9, which we were just talking about. It's the one that Jennifer Doudna's group studied and, of course, ended up winning her the Nobel Prize. But since then, we've found many, many more CRISPRs that can break nucleic acids. Where do we find new CRISPRs and how are they identified?
Yes. So there's a huge diversity in CRISPR systems in nature. And we find CRISPR systems by, I think, making use of the fact that sequencing has become such an easy thing to do and relatively affordable thing to do. And with the explosion of sequencing technology, with Illumina and other companies that are allowing us to get the sequences of genomes of bacteria and other species, we've been able to just look at the genomes in nature. And then we are able to find patterns of genes and congregations of genes to find things that relate to each other. And so, for example, the CRISPR-Cas systems, usually they go in one group where you have the main, so for example, Cas9, you have Cas9, you have the CRISPR sequence, which is the sequence of RNA that eventually becomes the guide RNAs. And you also have these other accessory Cas genes, usually Cas1 and 2, which are involved in bringing in more spacers into the natural CRISPR system or into the natural CRISPR array. And essentially what you do is you try to find, so if you want to find a new Cas9, you could look for a CRISPR array in the genome of this new bacteria you sequenced, or you can look for Cas1 and 2 or anything that looks like a Cas1 and 2 in the genomes. And this expands to kind of like a much more elaborate bioinformatic approach. I'm not too studied in this. And there are a lot of people who are really, really, really good at doing this, where they just look for even domains of proteins that are, that are present in like a Cas9 and see, what kind of protein has this domain, this functional part that Cas9 has, and what does it do? And that's how you kind of branch away from just looking at different versions of Cas9 to like different proteins that maybe do something similar to Cas9, for example.
Yeah. And this search process has unearthed a large number of new CRISPRs, but at the core, they're all doing the same thing, right? Each has its own properties and characteristics, but they're really just targeted nucleic acid cutters. Mm-hmm. Some bioengineers have developed, quote unquote, CRISPR 2.0, which is a group of CRISPR mutants or fusions to generate new functionality. But in the wild, so every CRISPR system we've discovered simply finds a part of the genome and then makes a cut. That is until your group, Feng Zhang's group at the Broad Institute, found two new CRISPRs with very different mechanisms. Can you tell us what these do?
Yes. So I do want to go back to the first point because it's very interesting that, so the native CRISPR systems, what they do is they are they have been evolved to fight against phages. And that's why they're so good at recognizing DNA targets or sometimes RNA targets, because this is the role that they play in, say, a bacteria where they come from, where these bacteria living in nature are getting bombarded by bacteriophages, which are viruses that infect these bacteria. And so the way that they defend against these phages is that they recognize the DNA of these phages or these viruses, and then they destroy those pieces of DNA. And this is the main role of the majority of the CRISPR-Cas systems we found to date. And so when Joe Peters and Eugene Koonin, which are two of the main people who were involved in finding these new CRISPR, when they found these systems, it was a very interesting question, because they found essentially CRISPR-Cas systems that looked like they had full targeting capabilities. So they had the guide RNA, they had the Cas, in this case, there were multiple Cas proteins that form a complex. The Cas genes that are involved in finding and binding the target specified by the spacer. But this system lacked a nuclease. So it lacked a component that allowed the system to cut DNA, which is what the majority of the other CRISPR-Cas systems are meant to do. In addition, they were found on these transposons. And so transposons are sometimes colloquially known as jumping genes. They're essentially just pieces of DNA that are able to jump around. And as they jump around, they facilitate sometimes exchange of DNA. Sometimes it's just completely selfish. They are just jumping so that they can propagate in more different species.
What do you mean by jumping around?
Right. So if you think about a piece of DNA, right, a piece of double-stranded DNA, you can think of that as, oh, either it's, you know, being melted to make more copies of the DNA, or it's being transcribed to make RNA. But oftentimes when a transposon is involved, you actually have physical movement of DNA where the piece of DNA that is the transposon is cut completely from its original source and moved to a different site, say in the same genome or maybe on a plasmid, and inserted into that site. And so essentially you have a piece of DNA being moved from point A to point B. And there's a lot of, you know, different mechanisms involved in this movement. Sometimes it's a what's called a cut and paste, where you essentially just cut and paste the DNA. Sometimes it's copy and paste, where you copy the DNA and paste it somewhere else. And that's essentially what a transposon does. It does this by involving what are called transposase genes. So these are genes that recognize the ends of the transposons and facilitates their nucleus activity that cuts it out from the starting location and inserts it into the end location. And the common family of transposons that have been studied is the TN7 transposon. And just in brief, the TN7 transposon has two modes of inserting into a target once it's cut out from the starting location. It can insert into a plasmid. And so a plasmid is just a DNA shuttle that, you know, is sometimes moved around between different bacteria. And when it does this, it does it randomly. So it just jumps in somewhere on the plasmid. Or it can insert into a site on the genome. And when it does this, it uses a different protein that guides it into that site. And it's a very fixed site. It's always the same exact sequence, always in the same exact place in the genome. It's almost like a safe haven that the transposon has evolved to jump into. And this second pathway is mediated by a protein called TNSD. And then TNS A, B, and C are the ones that are doing the cutting and pasting. So when Peters and Koonin found these transposons back in like 2017, they saw that the transposon, a TN7-like transposon that they saw, didn't have a TNSD. It had a slightly different protein, and it has a CRISPR system that didn't have a nuclease activity. And so the question is, okay, this transposon system doesn't seem to have a guide, a targeting protein to tell it where to go. And this CRISPR system doesn't have a nuclease activity, so it can find a target. It doesn't do anything with the target. And so it's almost like, with hindsight, this was such an obvious connection that what these two were doing together. But it took us, you know, like, or it took the field a year for my lab and Feng Zhang's lab to come up with the proof that essentially we had found at the same time a new kind of CRISPR system and a new kind of transposon. So the CRISPR system here is no longer an anti-phage system that is always on the search for phage DNA to destroy that phage DNA. Instead, it's now repurposed as a guide for the transposon, the piece of jumping DNA. And now this DNA, this jumping DNA, this transposon, is no longer either random or fixed. It's no longer only going into the same exact sequence. It can now be reprogrammed the same way a CRISPR system is reprogrammed by simply changing the spacer sequence of the guide RNA.
And so now there's a bit of a difference between the two CRISPRs found, between your group and Feng Zhang's group. Like, can you describe that difference?
Yeah, so this plays in, again, to the diversity of CRISPR systems. So even in the canonical CRISPR systems that are nuclease, that are anti-phage CRISPR systems, there's a huge diversity, and they're usually split into two main classes. And the biggest difference between the main classes, the class 1 and class 2 CRISPR systems, is the class 1 are kind of the clunky multi-protein subunit CRISPR systems. Essentially, the targeting component of class 1 systems are composed of a complex of multiple proteins at multiple copies. The class 2 are the more elegant CRISPR systems that only uses a single protein for each system to target DNA. And so Cas9 or Cas12 and Cas13 are members of this class. And so this also translates to our CRISPR transposon, where the system that my lab studied is the Type 1F system from Vibrio cholera. And this system, the CRISPR-Cas component of it was a multi-subunit complex, whereas the system that Feng Zhang's group found was a Type 5K that uses a Cas12K system. And that's a single subunit that does everything from binding guide RNA to binding the target.
There's a joke popular in ComSci, coined by a Netscape builder, Phil Carlton, that goes, you know, there's only two hard things in computer science, cache invalidation and naming things. And so in an effort to show that this joke applies equally to biology, your group, the Sternberg group, and the Jang group chose to call this new capability by totally different names. You and the Sternbergians call it integrate, short for insertion of transposable elements by guide RNA-assisted targeting, while the Zhangs call it CAST, short for CRISPR-associated transposase. So first, why the disagreement on names? Why can't we all just, you know, get along? And second, do you want to make the case for the integrate name?
That's a great question. Also, I've never heard Sternbergians before. Maybe we'll steal that for our own internal uses.
You're welcome to it.
That's funny because I've always been, as a grad student who's, you know, learning the ropes as I'm doing this kind of research in the CRISPR field, I've always been fascinated by all the acronyms and all the names that people come up with. And I think it's because even for projects that are simply answering biological questions about CRISPR systems, it's always kind of the underlying implication that maybe this one day this finding will have some technological implication. And it's really strong for our case, where we found like a really interesting CRISPR system, but also for other, you know, like other methods that and other techniques that people have come up with, other findings. And so I think that always compels people to give a name to these findings or to these methods, techniques. And sometimes it just becomes a bit too forced or a bit too crazy. So in our case, we knew for sure that we wanted an acronym when we were basically talking about this paper before we submitted the paper. And funnily enough, we had CAST as one of the candidates for the, because which is basically just a very simple, you know, CAST is Cas9, Cas12, like that's been in use, and then just add a T to it to make transposon. So we had that idea, but I think my PI Sam was the one who was like, that's too simple or that's too boring, so we need something else. And so it's funny that when we saw that Feng went with CAST as the acronym. So integrate was a much more elaborate name. And I think we wanted something more elaborate because it was harder to accidentally use it in a quick sentence. But then again, it's funny because integrate is also just a verb that describes what the system does. And so whenever I write something that has the system, I can't use the verb integrate. I have to use like insert or, you know, like something similar. So yeah, I don't really have, I think at some point the field would choose one of the two or one of the three, because I think people have also been calling these CRISPR transposons, which is, you know, like a good way to describe what these systems are. They're CRISPR transposons. So one day, you know, the field will choose one. Until then, I guess I'm just holding my breath.
Fair enough, yeah. So actually, before we dive into integrate, why do we even need targeted gene integration? What do we as a society use this kind of mechanism for?
The ability to integrate large sequences of genomes or large sequences of DNA. It's not entirely new or entirely, you know, like a groundbreaking concept. But I think as the field slowly moves away from the double-strand break method of the alpha versions of Cas9, this almost, I can see, at least in the mammalian system, the human cells, there's a bit of a fork in the road where back in the day, the double-strand break could do both, right? It could be used to insert small changes or really large sequences. Essentially, you put either one on your donor DNA, and that gets incorporated into the cut. In the newer versions, and going back to the talk about the newer fusions, the new mutations of Cas, CRISPR-Cas systems, there's a lot of really amazing work coming out of David Liu's lab, where they're building these base editors or these, recently the prime editors that are both skipping this double-strand break and are really, really efficient and amazing systems that are able to make small changes. So in the base editor, there are single base changes. And in the prime editor, it's small, you know, like 10, 20, 30 bases of change, either insertions, deletions, or mutations, or substitutions. And so given that advancement in the ability to go to bypass the double-strand break to make small changes, I guess the need now is to be able to bypass the double-strand break to make large changes, so large insertions. And there is where you really can't use a base editor or a prime editor because, you know, it's really hard to use either of these systems to make, you know, like a 5 kb insertion. So there is a need for a system that doesn't require a double-strand break to be repaired by the cell and is able to insert a large cargo. And so what you want to insert with this is you could insert a gene, you could insert an entire pathway, an exon, which is a part of the gene into the mammalian genome. In bacteria, you could insert, you know, like, yeah, entire pathways that are able to generate different molecules, say if you want to apply the system to biosynthesis of molecules. And so the potential of what you can do with insertion is huge. And I think there really, as the field evolves more and more, I think it's going to be much more of a need to be able to insert large DNA sequences and to do it without having to rely on the host, because that's what the transposons are also able to do really well, is that they can act as selfish elements that essentially they are systems that are able to act independently of the host, sometimes against the host even, but, and that's why they're so powerful, because now you can separate your editing away from needing to tweak the host repair of DNA.
And so in this paper, you focused on CRISPR-mediated integrations in bacterial cells. Mm-hmm. So before your method, how are we getting new genes into bacteria? And did they even need to be integrated into the bacterial genome?
Yeah, so one of the main uses of inserting things into the genomes of bacteria is to insert genes or pathways that allow the bacteria to be repurposed into almost a biological factory to build or produce proteins or enzymes or molecules. And in theory, you could maintain these genes or pathways on a plasmid. So these small DNA molecules or these small DNA circles that are separate from the main genome of the bacteria. And the reason why you might want to not do this is because it's harder to really stably maintain a gene like that, especially a gene that is producing something that's taxing on the cells. And so in order to make sure that as you go through generations of using this bacteria to produce something, and I'm sure the SynthBio people will have much more expertise on this, but in order to make sure that you have stability of the gene being maintained in your cell and also being able to tightly control the number of copies of that gene, you want to put it into the genome and not just to keep it on the plasmid. And so that might be why you want to insert a gene into the genome. And I think as we go further and further into kind of the future of SynthBio, I think basically being able to insert or modify genomes is a huge need and would be a huge boost to the ability to build these bacterial chassis, which are bacteria that are able to be fully customized for one purpose.
Obviously, the paper that preceded this work focused on showing that this new CRISPR can integrate DNA at all, right? So you weren't overly focused on optimizing it. What were some of the limitations of this previous system that you improved upon in this paper?
Yeah, so the first paper we published on this system was purely a biological description of what the system was, because that was the first time that we showed to the world what a CRISPR transposon system is and what it can do. And what are the potential applications of CRISPR transposon could be. And in doing that, we basically skipped over demonstrations of how efficient the system could be. And we skipped over, you know, streamlining or optimizing the system. It's all just to get to describing what a CRISPR transposon system is. And so there were several flaws or several shortcomings of that first description. Basically, we used a lot of different plasmids together to introduce the system into cells. And so the system requires 7 separate genes, a CRISPR array that produces the guide RNA, and the what's called the donor DNA, which is essentially the transposon DNA that's being moved around. We introduced these components on 3 separate plasmids, and that was honestly a very clunky way to do it, but it was fast because we didn't have to do any optimization and streamlining. And so that was the first thing that I worked on, was to improve the simplicity of inserting or introducing such a system into cells. And so I was building what we were calling an all-in-one plasmid, or now it's called a P-spin on a paper. Essentially, it's a single plasmid that introduces all the components and the donor DNA, and that requires a single insertion event of the plasmid into the cells to essentially fully introduce the system. I also played around with the promoter, which is the piece of DNA that tells the cells to transcribe the DNA downstream of that promoter. And that's the signal that tells the cells to make the genes that are part of the system. And in the initial paper, we had 3 separate promoters that were driving the 7 genes and the CRISPR RNA. And I played around with basically just thinking that the initial idea was that I was thinking that we would have to change those promoters if we were to, you know, play around with like different expression levels of the system. I was like, I don't want to really want to clone like 3 separate promoters every single time and do this. So I was like, what if I could just use a single one and just chain all the components together in one piece of mRNA, one transcript, which would then be processed by different components of the cell and the system into the separate parts that it needs to function. And so it was a very Hail Mary, like, you know, let's just try this, see if it works. And it works like beautifully. It worked even better than the separate system that we were using. And so that was like one of the moments where I was like, well, you know, I'll take it. So that was the first bit of optimization, which is the delivery and streamlining the components needed for that delivery.
You made a lot of really great improvements, but my favorite was actually increasing this payload size, right? So in your previous paper, you had found that new CRISPRs could only integrate about 1 kilobase of genetic information, or a string of 1,000 A's, T's, G's, and C's. But by messing with the way you just simply grew the bacteria, you found you could integrate up to 10 kilobases. First, what perturbation made this possible? And second, at a high level, can you tell us why you think this perturbation improved the payload size?
Right. So the perturbation was basically you take the E. coli. So E. coli in the lab, we grow them during what's called an overnight culture, where we start with a few cells either in liquid media or on a plate. And we would grow them at 37 degrees in an incubator over like 12, 16, 20 hours. And the reason why 37 degrees has been chosen by the field for like decades now is because E. coli is a gut bacteria, or it's one of the bacteria you find in the gut, and the human gut is about 37 degrees. And so that's the most obvious temperature you use to grow E. coli. And they grow really, really fast. You know, within 10, 12 hours, you go from, you know, a clear media to an opaque, a cloudy, fully grown culture. And so that's what I've always been taught is, you know, you grow E. coli at 37. But for some reason, when you grow E. coli at 30 or 25 degrees, when we try to insert genes using this system, becomes really, really efficient at inserting not even just 1-2 KB, but up to 10,000 base pairs of DNA. And it's efficient, and it's still very, very much the same specificity of targeting that we had at the 37 degree incubation. And we're still looking into why this is the case, and also if this translates beyond E. coli to other models or other hosts that we're using the system on. It might be, you know, it could very well be something that's unique to E. coli, which is our initial host model species to test the system. It could be something true for bacteria that grow rapidly at 37 degrees, because the CRISPR transposon system we got came from a Vibrio species, which the Vibrio genus of bacteria, a lot of them are ocean dwelling. So they, you know, usually they grow at like, I guess, ocean temperature, which is not 37 degrees. And so maybe the system has just evolved to work so much better at a lower temperature that, you know, simply reducing the temperature of incubation of E. coli enhances the efficiency. It could also be something to do with the physiology of the cells, where maybe there are certain changes to the E. coli genome when the cells are growing rapidly at 37 degrees that are inhibiting the efficiency of the system as compared to when you slow down this growth, which happens when you grow E. coli at 37 degrees or at room temperature, the cells grow much slower. And so if you slow down this growth, maybe there's a bigger window for some optimal state of the cell for the system to exert its activity. And maybe that's why we see a higher efficiency.
I think this begs the question, though, you know, was this a planned experiment or was it a bit of serendipity, right? Did you just accidentally leave a culture on your bench overnight that was meant to go in the incubator and were pleasantly surprised when you came in the morning?
Sometimes I wish that was the case. And, you know, I love one of those like accidental scientific findings. It was not fully intentional what we did here with the temperature, because I definitely didn't go into this thinking I want to modify the temperature of incubation as one of the metrics for optimization. The way we came across this was interesting. So as one of the things that I was looking at was the backbone of the plasmid that we used to deliver the system into cells. And so the backbone essentially is the rest of the plasmid that doesn't include the actual system that we're introducing. And so I thought that because different backbones allow the plasmid to be maintained at different copies in the cells, and so we thought that changing the backbone might change the efficiency of integration, which it did to some extent. One of the backbones I tested was a temperature-sensitive backbone. It's used for a very clever purpose. So the idea is that if you introduce the system, the genes of the system, the CRISPR transposon, on a plasmid into cells to insert a cargo somewhere in the genome, once that cargo is inserted, you want to potentially remove the system from the cells so that the cell can now be, you know, edited further or used for some purpose. And so one of the ways that people do that is they use this temperature-dependent plasmid that is maintained in the cells at 30 degrees, but is basically removed from the cells naturally as the cell is grown at 37. And so the incubation there is that you would incubate the cells with the plasmid at 30 degrees, which is suboptimal for E. coli. And then you would, once you've confirmed that you've made the change, then when you've made the insertion, you then grow the cells at 37. And when I was using this backbone, I saw that for some reason, the efficiency was really, really high. And for the longest time, we thought that that was because the backbone itself was really good for some reason. But then eventually, you know, I remember me and my PI, we were talking about just maybe the temperature has something to do with this. And then I tested the temperature going down to 30 and 25, and then boom, it was just amazingly efficient. And that was, you know, one of those moments where it was very unexpected, but also, you know, it was a huge finding because that allowed us to, for the first time, insert 10,000 base pairs at essentially close to 100% efficiency, as in, you know, every single cell that we tried to insert the system or insert the transposon containing the cargo genes, it was happening essentially at max rate.
So you have Integrate working, and now you put yourself in the shoes of a strain engineer, right? So a strain engineer's job is to make genetic modifications to microbes so that they can complete some specific task, like expressing a commodity protein or molecule. One thing a strain engineer might want to do is insert two different cargos at two different sites. When you tried this with Integrate, I was surprised at how difficult it actually was to do. What were some of the issues you faced?
Right. So one of the main issues of making multiple insertions came with essentially a natural way for the system to prevent accidental multiple insertions. The idea is that the way even a natural, like a normal TN7 transposon works, so you have target binding with the CRISPR system at the target site, and then you have insertion of the transposon a bit downstream, a bit of a distance away from that target site. And the effect of it is that the target was never changed or modified or disrupted. And so in theory, you could have multiple events of the same target being recognized and bound and multiple insertions of a transposon, just one after the other downstream of the target site. And so in theory, you could have like five copies of the transposon being pasted in next to this target site that is recognized by the transposon CRISPR parts of the transposon. So the system in nature evolved a way to stop this from happening. And we still don't really know the underlying mechanism of how this happens and what's required. But essentially, once you have the first insertion in, there is now a repression activity against multiple insertions after the first one. And so once you've made one insertion, making another insertion into the exact same site becomes very, very inefficient. And it actually extends to a distance away from the first insertion. So even if you try to go 500 base pairs or a KB away from the first insertion, there's still a decrease in efficiency because of this, what's called the target immunity effect. And eventually, if you go far enough away, so say you go like 10,000 or 50,000 base pairs away, that effect dies down, and now you can actually insert multiple components or multiple copies of the transposon. And so that was something that we think that, you know, for a lot of purposes where you want to insert a DNA cargo into the genome of bacteria, you probably don't always want to insert the same thing very close to each other. But if you want to do that, it actually becomes quite tough because of this effect. And so what we thought was the reason why there is an effect in the first place is probably because the transposon that has been inserted into the genome is being recognized by the proteins involved in that insertion. And so one way you can actually make an insertion of something else nearby is to use a completely different CRISPR transposon system where the two transposons don't see each other essentially. And so that's what we tried. We tried using, we had on hand a type 5 system, which is the Cas12k driven CRISPR transposon system that we had found, and we tried to insert that nearby, and there is now no crosstalk between the two systems because the transposon ends are so different from each other that, you know, transposon A doesn't interact with transposon B. And so now you reduce the effect of having, or the immunity effect of repression when you try to insert multiple copies. And so the downside here is that you have to use multiple different systems to make these insertions when they're close to each other. But, you know, you can do it without having to worry about a decrease in efficiency.
Yeah, awesome. So a second thing a strain engineer may want to do is to put the same insert at multiple places in the genome. And this might be to increase the copy number such that there's, you know, more protein available to, or more of that gene available to the cell, or so that the cell can find less ways to kind of get around expressing that gene. So you were able to find a way to do this quite elegantly. Can you explain how you pulled it off and also how you tested it?
Yeah, so one of the key advantages of a CRISPR system over, you know, like the old school Talon or zinc finger nucleases is what's called multiplexing. And the idea is that it's so easy to print a piece of RNA that contains your spacer that it's easy to print 3 or 4 or 5 at the same time and use all of those in the same cell to make multiple changes to all these different target sites at the same time. And that's something that we wanted to demonstrate with our new CRISPR transposon, is that can you do multiplexing with a CRISPR transposon? Because the idea is that all you would need is you would need multiple spacers. And so in the paper, we tried using a multi-spacer CRISPR array, where it's a single CRISPR array, but instead of encoding only one guide RNA, it encodes two or three, each one with a different spacer mapping to a different site in the genome. And the idea is that you can use this single plasmid that contains a single CRISPR array that contains three spacers to at the same time hit three sites in the genome and insert, you know, three copies into three predetermined sites. One of the labs that have been working on these CRISPR transposons for bacterial engineering actually took this and ran with it, you know, to the max, where they tried to insert like 7 or 8 or 9 copies of a pathway that makes a small molecule into the E. coli cell and try to see if they can increase the amount of synthesis of this molecule. And it works really, really well. And the system was able to, at the same time, insert, you know, 5, 7, 9 copies of the system. In our case, we wanted in this paper to show that you can do this, and also that it actually is going into the same cell. So the idea is that if you look at a population of cells and you look at the three target sites, you would see that, you know, if you use a triple spacer array, you would hit the three sites. But can you really prove that each individual cell within this entire population of E. coli is seeing three insertions into the same genome? Or, you know, like one cell is getting hit at site A, and then one cell is getting hit at site B, and another hit at site C. And so the way I did this was I ran this experiment where I was knocking out these genes that are encoding for essential amino acids. And so when you grow E. coli in rich media, so we use LB media, which is a standard way to grow E. coli across, you know, many labs in the world. And in this media, you essentially supply all the nutrients needed for E. coli to survive. But you actually can grow E. coli in very minimal media that contains only certain salts that provide, you know, phosphates, sulfur, nitrates, and a carbon source. And E. coli can actually synthesize all the amino acids it needs to survive using multiple different genes in its genome. So the idea is that if you knock out two of these genes and you try to grow E. coli on this minimum media, it will not grow unless you add the two exact amino acids that these genes are required to make. And so this is what's called an autotrophic knockout of E. coli. So that was the simple experiment that we did. The idea is that if one cell is getting hit by, we targeted genes encoding for threonine and glutamine. And the idea is that each cell that sees both knockouts will only survive if you add back both threonine and glutamine into the media that we grow the E. coli in. If one cell is only getting knockout in threonine and the other one is only getting knockout in glutamine, then the response will be very much different. And so that's the experiment we ran, and we used a double spacer array to hit both these genes, to insert a cargo into the genes, knocking them out. And the cells, as we expected, only grew when you add back both amino acids into the media. And so that was a very nice demonstration of the fact that these knockouts or these insertions of the transposon were happening in the same molecules of genomic DNA.
Awesome. And did those, I guess, double knockouts in this case, was it still at 100% efficiency?
It was lower, but I didn't run this experiment at 30 degrees. I ran it at like a standard 37.
Got you.
Yeah.
Cool. Finally, a strain engineer would need this integrate system to work in a bunch of different bacterial species, right? Not just the E. coli that we kind of use in lab. You showed that this could work in two other strains that are pretty useful for biotech and health. But my favorite part of this whole piece was a proof of concept delivery method to get integrate into a gut microbiome. How did you do this?
Right. And so this was done in collaboration with the Harris Wang lab, which is also at Columbia. And they are kind of the bacterial experts, where, you know, we kind of joke, we have the hammer and they have the nails in a way. And the idea is that if you try to engineer, say, E. coli on the Petri dish in a lab, it's easy to do. You know, there's been years of experiments showing that you can insert DNA into E. coli through a plasmid, very easily through multiple different techniques. But if you try to kind of evolve the system to work in a more applied setting where, say, you want to modify some gut microbiome or some gut bacteria, then it becomes harder because the gut bacteria of interest that you want to target may not be so amenable to what's called a transformation. So it's not, you know, people haven't been studying that thing on a petri dish in a lab environment. And so the idea is that you want to try a newer way of inserting DNA into cells. And so what we did was we applied a technique from the Wang lab where they were doing conjugations of using a donor E. coli into a recipient. Essentially, it's mimicking the way that bacteria in nature exchange DNA information. They exchange DNA on plasmids through the process of conjugation where one bacteria acts as the donor, essentially donating the plasmid, and another one acts as the recipient, receiving the plasmid. And so obviously only the bacteria that has the plasmid can donate it, but it can be received by multiple different species if there is a multi-species mix of bacteria. The idea is that we took an idea from the Wang lab where they introduced a plasmid containing a set of genes of choice to a population of gut microbiome using a donor DNA. We used that technique and used a plasmid that contains our transposon system. And that allowed us to introduce our transposon, the CRISPR transposon, into multiple different recipients. And then using the spacer of the CRISPR system, we were able to target just a single species within that microbial mix. And so that allows you to kind of narrow down the broad recipient list and just target what you want to target, because only the desired species had the DNA target for the spacer of your CRISPR system. So that's the kind of the idea of, at the same time, kind of spreading your system into multiple recipients, but then only targeting the ones you want to target.
Love that. Yeah, targeted integration and targeted species, mm-hmm. right? That's really, really going to be the holy grail of microbiome engineering. So papers only really allow us to showcase what worked, right? But failures are usually what really leads us to discover new biology. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about some failure in the process that ended up being in a really important part of your understanding of Integrate?
Yeah, so I would say there was a lot of troubleshooting that went into this paper, you know, a lot of grinding, a lot of hours. I would say the biggest thing that I kind of think about when I think about things not working out fully for this paper was that we were running out of time to really do more with it. And the reason was because we knew that, you know, like there was a lot of interest in these CRISPR transposons. A lot of labs were trying to apply it to different applications, different bacterial species. And so we only had a set amount of time to get this paper out the door before, you know, we were going to be able to, you know, be the first one to showcase right. some of these ideas. And definitely when I was working on this project, I wanted to do a lot more with, you know, like the last bits where we were going to go into more different bacterial species, doing much more community-driven experiments instead of just hitting one or two species at one time. And I think that would have taken like an extra 3-4 months. And we basically just didn't have that time because the field was catching up to our kind of head start already. So that was kind of the biggest regret, is that, you know, if I had 4 more months, I could have done something really cool with this. But maybe that'll be, you know, part of a next project for me or someone else in the lab to tackle.
So looking forward, you know, what still needs to be optimized and Integrate before we see it being used in every strain engineering operation?
So right now there's a huge promise with the potential of the system, because again going back to the idea that these things are transposons, and transposons are really good at being spread from one strain to the other because all they need is a DNA target for them to jump into. So we already have some really cool preliminary data from the lab that shows that this thing is working in bacterial species that are of importance that have not so far been able to be subjected to the same level of DNA engineering, including ones that have not been able to be modified at all in the past. And so that's something that's really exciting for us. I think one of the key barriers of entry for the system is translating the expression and the delivery of the system into multiple different bacteria. And so, for example, you know, in E. coli, you have a very similar bacterial species to the host of the system where we found the system in, which is the Vibrio cholera species. And so going from Vibrio to E. coli is simple because the cells are very similar, or the species are very similar. But going from, say, Vibrio to Staph aureus, which is, you know, going from a gram negative to a gram positive, there, you know, you might have to make certain changes to the way that you deliver and the way that you express these genes in the new host so that you have sufficient expression of the components needed to have the system be active.
You know, looking even beyond bacteria, how long until we see integrate in plant cells or in human cells?
So there's a huge amount of interest, again, going back to the idea that you want to go away from double-strand breaks in mammalian cells and the potential of what you can do with making large insertions in mammalian cells. And there, I'm going to have to give a boring answer, which is I'm not allowed to talk about any of this.
Cool. And okay, so in your wildest dreams, and like really call up your most optimistic self here, what do you envision integrate being used for in bacteria over the long term?
In my wildest dreams. So I think if we go, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line with this technology, everything works out perfectly and we, you know, work out all the knots, all the optimizations needed, it could be a very powerful tool to make changes, not just to one, two species, but to entire microbiome systems, maybe in the gut or in nature, where instead of engineering, you know, one strain to do one thing, you engineer a population of bacteria of more than one, or, you know, maybe dozens, tens of dozens of species to have a unified purpose of, you know, improving the gut health or making certain changes to the environment. And so these are, you know, ideas that I think are very much possible, but I think it will require some work because the technology is still in its early days. But it's very exciting to see where it can go because bacteria are everywhere and they do many, many, or they take on many, many important roles in both health and nature.
So you're talking about a sort of strain agnostic microbiome engineering.
Essentially, that would be the dream, yes.
That sounds pretty cool. Well, we agree there's incredible potential with this technology, and we would certainly love to see you involved in helping manifest it. So, Leo, thanks so much for joining us on Translation.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of Translation. If you're an author of an upcoming paper in bio or know of any interesting papers dropping soon and want to hear from the authors, send us an email to translation@50.vc. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time, good bio.